I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 4th of December. This article caught our attention in the Washington Post yesterday. Wearing yellow badges and traveling in groups of 10 or more, agency review teams for President-elect Barack Obama have swarmed into dozens of government offices from the Pentagon to the National Council on Disability. With pointed questions and clear ground rules, they are dissecting agency initiatives, poring over budgets, and unearthing documents that may prove crucial as a new Democratic president assumes control. Our guest this first hour will look at the transition process and how to make a transition a smooth one. Professor Martha Joint Kumar is with us, and she is the director of the White House Transition Project, which is going on for some time now. She's a professor in the Department of Political Science at Towson University and a scholar with a research focus on the White House, interested in presidential press relations, White House communications operations, and presidential transitions. Her most recent book is Managing the President's Message, the White House Communications Operation, and she is director of the White House Transition Project, working with two dozen presidency scholars preparing information on White House operations for people inside and outside of government who are interested in the 2009 presidential transition. Later this hour, James Feifner will join us, professor in the School of Public Policy at George Mason University, and his special areas of interest are the presidency, American national government, and public management. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do, for our guests, and our number is 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, the email address today is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And while we're lining up our guest, who we don't have at the moment, but we'll try and reach her momentarily, second hour of our program today, a really entertaining book. Imagine putting all of this together in about 397 pages. Mental Floss's History of the World, an irreverent romp through civilization's best bits. We will be talking about the history of the world. Here's a little topic, huh? The second hour of our program with one of the editors of Mental Floss and one of the co-authors of this highly entertaining, and many are saying, if I could only have learned history through a book like this, history would have been absolutely fascinating, which it is anyhow, but this book makes it a whole lot of fun. So that's coming up, hour number two of our program. And we welcome your thoughts about the transition process this hour. I didn't realize how many people are already in the White House going through files and asking questions about what do I need to know when I start my new job on day one. We'll look at the cabinet appointments as well that have already taken place and those that are likely to take place in the coming days. Martha is going to be joining us from the White House, where she is busy at work. And all of that's coming up in just one moment. She has said that she's been doing interviews because, based on what all of the scholars know about the transitions, there are certain things that work and certain things that don't work. Some of the presidential transitions have been criticized for being extremely sloppy and getting new administrations off to a very slow start. Many are saying that this can't happen during this new administration because there simply is so much on the table. She says that people making a transition from campaigning to governing are not just the president-elect and his campaign team, but reporters are making that change as well. They need to have some sense of what's involved in the transition, and her work has been invaluable to the men and women in politics, and she feels great pride for it. She said, and she's been doing this job for several administrations, when she interviewed people in 1999 to 2000, it was good because people thought about what they learned and what they wanted to tell their successors. They gathered information that's practical, very rewarding, she said, working on behalf of a group of people who've done a lot of very serious work, and it's nice to see their work used and also valued. Her book which I mentioned earlier, managing the president's message. The White House Communications Operation won the award for best political book on the presidency from the American Political Science Association, and she is being inducted in the National Academy of Public Administration, a group that is chartered by Congress. What happens is when she believes that someone will become an integral part of the White House, she often sends him or her information regarding the position. And this is where she's received a lot of compliments of her professional career. I know that it will be useful for them. I contacted someone that I thought was going to be involved in a coming White House administration, and that person who I sent two essays to has said that he already read them, which is great. So we hope that she's going to be We'll be connecting with her, we hope, in just a few moments. And we will also be talking this hour with James Feifner, who will join us later in the hour, who is at the School of Public Policy at George Mason University and actually has a very strong Wisconsin roots, grew up in Stevens Point, as did his father, his grandfather, and his great-grandfather. And he went to UW-Madison for his bachelor's, master's, and PhD. He is University Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University, and his major areas of expertise are the presidency, American national government, and public management. And he has written or edited a dozen books on the presidency and American national government, including The Strategic Presidency, Hitting the Ground Running, Power Play, The Bush Presidency, and The Constitution. So all of that will be coming up, and maybe we'll have to go to him first, but at the moment, we don't have anybody, so we're just here talking. But what do you think of the appointments that have taken place? We'll also look at the praise that President-elect Obama has received and some criticism from progressives that he hasn't included enough progressive voices in his cabinet positions. Has he gone about announcing staff positions, which we just don't know about? What process, what progress has been made in that regard? We will talk about that. And because Professor Kumar says that it's important to get those positions filled while you're doing your cabinet positions as well. So that's our lineup for today, we hope, in just a few moments. And you also, I'm sure, you smart listeners, have some knowledge of other transitions that maybe didn't go very well. I believe that the Clinton administration and the Carter administration were criticized for not being as smooth as they should, for not having appointments in place or having vetted potential cabinet positions well enough so that they could sail through the Senate, that there had to be several choices and, you know, sometimes fairly long delays before people were announced for their various positions. So that's what we're doing. And we're just going to start then with James Feifner. Okay. We will do that. And welcome your phone calls for him, 800-486-8655. That was a long few minutes. And we hope that Professor Kumar will be joining us a little bit later. I've already given his introduction and everybody's introduction, so he'll join us right now. Professor Feifner, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you.
And you have a long history here in Wisconsin. We like that.
Yeah, so do I.
I know. You must miss it.
I sure do. Well, except in the wintertime.
Right. Except today. You wouldn't want to be here today, or it looks like it's going to be a long winter. Well, let's talk about this transition process. How would you answer the question, what makes for a smooth transition?
What makes – it really takes a lot of planning. People have to start very early, months early. So the Obama people have been going at least since June, and I presume the McCain people were preparing also, because there's just so much to do to get ready, and you can't wait till after the election in order to start. So lead time planning is the key here.
Isn't that something you're preparing since June for a job you're not sure you're going to have?
Well, that's right, but it's only prudent that you have to do it, because if you wait, all of a sudden everything hits you at once. You've got to recruit all of these people in the cabinet for the White House staff, but also really thousands more people. And you've got to get together your policy agenda. You've got to make connections with Congress. There's all sorts of things that have to be done, and so you've got to start early. And largely this is because the United States government is so much larger and more complex now. Back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, it didn't take very much in terms of planning, but now it does.
Mm-hmm. So we're looking at how many jobs that need to be filled. It's a huge number, isn't it?
It certainly is. The key jobs are about 3,000 total in the executive branch. Well, but there's also another about 900 in the White House staff itself, and another several thousand that are part-time, honorary, and so forth. But the key is, say, the first about 800 are executives in the executive branch. This is at the very high levels, cabinet and sub-cabinet. Then there's non-career senior executive service, sort of top-level managers, and there's about 700 of those. And then there's what are called Schedule C positions, about 1,400. And these are lower levels in the executive bureaucracy. So there's lots of people.
Mm-hmm. And is President-elect Obama, we've heard about a lot of the cabinet positions, do those need to be in place before they can hire their staffs, and that includes a number of people, or is he already at work at putting together some of those White House positions?
Well, the White House positions, he's at work, and probably the top 20 or 25 people have already been designated. And this is really the key, because these are the people that have to organize the government for President-elect Obama. He's also working on the cabinet, but you've got to have White House staff people there to coordinate things. There's 15 separate cabinet agencies, and the only people that can coordinate them are people in the White House itself. So the top people have been designated, and then they are working on planning whom they might recruit. But the cabinet secretaries, there's always a struggle between the president or the White House and the cabinet secretaries as to who's going to appoint the people on the management team of the cabinet secretaries. And the secretaries think it should be my team and I should be able to designate these people, even though they're presidential appointments. The White House says, no, those are presidential people, and we get to appoint them. So it's always a struggle in every administration.
Mm-hmm. And we have found Professor Feifner, we found Professor Kumar, so we will introduce her and have the two of you talk. Professor Kumar, who's director of the White House Transition Project and professor in the Department of Political Science at Towson University. Hello, Professor Kumar. Thank you for being with us. Hello?
Hello.
Yes, there you are. Are you at the White House?
I am, and it was the briefing went longer than I thought it would. Dana Perino's daily briefing.
Uh-huh. So you're busy at work. Tell me what you think. We already asked Professor Feifner this. What makes for a smooth transition? What have we learned from other administrations coming in? What's good? What's not good?
You have to prepare well in advance. Think through who you're going to be putting into your White House staff, as Jim was saying. The White House staff is important because it sets up your decision-making system. You're putting in the chief of staff who is going to be hiring other people, and they're going to be thinking through what information the president needs in order to make a decision, and how does he like to get information. You need to have the counsel for the vetting process for nominees, and you need personnel, and you also need press to be talking about what it is you're doing, especially in this kind of time, because you can't make the President-elect Obama can't make decisions, but at the same time as official decisions as a president-elect, but what he can do is send signals through how he structures his decision-making system, who he appoints, what experience they have, and it will give you a sense of what his priorities are. So if you looked at the first week, that you would see that they did much more than is normally done. He was elected on the 4th, and by the end of the week, he had already come out with his economic team behind him and spoken. And having the economic team let people know that that was going to be his priority, which, if you looked at exit polling, was certainly the priority of the public. The next day, his representative, John Podesta, signed an agreement with the president, his representative, Josh Bolton, the chief of staff. It's called a Memorandum of Understanding, and that was signed on November 8th, which sets the ground rules for how they're going to work together on the transition, including the agency review teams, what kinds of rules they will be under when they go into the various departments and agencies and request information. And then the following Monday, and this is still in the first week, President-elect Obama and Michelle Obama came to Washington to speak with President Bush and Laura Bush. So that's a lot to be doing, yes, in the first week. Traditionally, that would take several weeks to do.
Until I started preparing for this show, I was thinking that the transition period was rather long because there are so many pressing problems. When I hear both of you speak, I'm thinking, oof, they've got so much on their table to get all these jobs filled that maybe it's not that long a time. What do you think?
I definitely think that we need at least this much time. Up until Franklin Roosevelt's time, the president didn't get inaugurated until the 4th of March. Then we changed the Constitution back to January 20th. But since that time, the U.S. government has become so large and complex that a new president definitely needs these 11 weeks to get ready to take office.
Right.
Yes, I think so, too, because you have to make that transition between campaigning and governing, and those are very different things. In campaigning, you and your staff have one goal, which is to win the election, and then your sub-goals are to win each day, and you paint your opponent as the bad guy and yourself as the good guy. When you're switching to governing is a much different thing. The timetable is often at the mercy of the congressional schedule. And you have to do a lot of compromising on legislation and on your policies. So you have to have people that can deal with nuance and can deal with those kinds of rhythms, and also people who have not made a lot of enemies during the time period of the campaign.
That's interesting. Tell me about whether or not you think compare this transition in terms of those that have not gone very well. A lot has been said about the Carter administration and the Clinton administration coming from outside Washington, perhaps delaying the start of attention to very important issues because they just weren't doing the transition very well.
Well, I think this transition has been done exceptionally well. I've looked carefully at other ones, and as you mentioned, the Carter administration, incidentally, he was the first campaigner who put significant resources into planning his transition starting in the summer of 1976. He took money away from the campaign because he knew that he was an outsider to Washington, did a lot of preparation, but the cooperation between the campaigners and the transition people, there was a lot of friction there, and it didn't work well when they got into Washington. He didn't pick a lot of people with experience with Congress, and that slowed him down with his policy agenda. So that was a slow transition. Bill Clinton's transition was a bit slow, too, in part because he tried designate his cabinet before he put together the White House staff, and that definitely slowed him down. Ronald Reagan did have a very effective transition. They started early in April of 1980 and really focused their policy agenda very narrowly. They carefully prepared their personnel operation and so forth, and that was very effective. But from my perspective, at least my impression now, is that this has been one of the most effective and efficient transitions that I've seen.
Would you agree, Professor Kumar?
Yes, I think so. And I think one of the reasons that the Reagan transition and the George W. Bush transitions went so well is their campaign agenda was their governing agenda. So they were able to come right in and talk about those things that were most important to them and that they had discussed with the public during the period of their campaign. So, for example, with George W. Bush, he had talked about education, faith-based initiatives, military buildup, tax cuts. And when he came in, he was able to just assign a week for each one of those as he began his presidency. And the advantage of that was to him is that first week he talked about education. He didn't talk about the murky election, mm-hmm. which if he had not had an agenda coming in, that would have been a problem because you can get just swept up by others who want to take your space and talk about their things.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, with Carter, when Carter came in, he talked about energy, he talked about executive reorganization, education, and it was unclear just where he wanted to go. And the result of that was that after a few months, the impression people had of him was a nice guy who didn't know just where he was going. And so that established a reputation for him, and it was hard for him to change it. On the other hand, with Reagan, when he came in, because, as Jim says, the personnel operation with Pendleton James, who was a professional headhunter, he had worked on information on the positions and possible people, and they named a chief of staff. Reagan named it in his second week, the chief of staff, James Baker, and his policy person, Ed Meese, and they all focused on what positions would relate to the priority issue, which was the economy. And they isolated 87 positions that they thought were crucial to the economy, and that's where they focused. And then when he came into office that first day, when he was still on the Hill, before he came down to the White House, he issued an executive order that put a freeze on federal government hiring. And that sent a message that he was interested in the economy and that he was taking it to his own government and exercising restraint there. And so then in mid-February, he talked about his economic program in a speech on the Hill to both houses of Congress. So he knew just what his priorities were, and he didn't talk about anything else. They all focused on that.
This president-elect, though, has been criticized for having spoken widely on issues like the economy, on foreign policy, on energy, et cetera. And he's already received some criticism from cabinet members, namely Senator Clinton, who had a different kind of foreign policy approach, that he may have said one thing and from these appointments we're not getting a very clear idea of where he's going.
The cabinet secretaries are going to be implementing policy that they will, to varying degrees, be involved in developing, but with the president and with the White House staff. And so they have experience, but their job is going to be to carry out the president's wishes rather than their own, and he's chosen them for their experience.
I think one of the strengths is that he has a very strong cabinet and White House staff, people who are going to disagree with each other, who have strong feelings and so forth. But that's the best thing for a president, because he or she needs to get all sides of the issues presented before a key decision is made. President-elect Obama seems like the kind of person who's going to be able to handle differences of opinion and make his own calls. And these are people on his team. They signed up, and they're going to go along with his final decision. But until that time, they're going to be giving him the best advice that they can.
Mm. And in that regard, it will be a very different administration, won't it, Professor Kumar?
Yes, it is. I mean, he's going to have something of a different policy orientation. Foreign policy is going to be different. One of his President-elect Obama's goals is to give a different view in the world of what the United States is, who we are. And I think he sent those signals this summer in July when he spoke in Berlin and elsewhere on his trip in Europe and to the Middle East.
Let's pause for just a moment. Professor Kumar can only be with us a couple more minutes. Professor Feifner will stay with us for the hour. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. So join us just as soon as you'd like. We're looking at the presidential transition, what needs to take place for a transition to go smoothly, what we can learn from other presidential transitions that may have gone well, that may not have gone well, what we can learn about the presidency and where this president-elect is going in terms of the appointments that have already been made, how they're handled, the political ideas, just the ideas of how to run government and various aspects of government that have been espoused by those already nominated. Our guests are Professor Martha Kumar, who's professor in the Department of Political Science at Towson University and director of the White House Transition Project. Professor James Feifner is a professor in the School of Public Policy at George Mason University. And we'll be with you, we hope. Call right now. 800-486-8655 is the number. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. Before we let Professor Kumar go, I'm just interested in what happens day-to-day with the White House Transition Project. Give me a better idea of the work that you're involved in, Professor Kumar.
Well, today I'd say is an unusual day. Today is the fourth meeting of the Transition Coordinating Council. That is a group that was that President Bush set up by executive order on October 9th that was preparing transition information for those that are going out of the government, and then to gather information and then provide it to the new team. And so today's meeting is going to have, this is the fourth meeting that's going to have the Obama people as well as the Bush people, and then they have a few outside guests, and I'm one of the outside guests.
Hmm.
And so that's not something that we've normally been involved in, although we have been providing information both to the White House and to both sides. One of the things that we did was pull together books that were important for a knowledge of presidential transitions for White House organizations, and Jim's books are among them. And I gave those books. I had got two sets of them, and gave them in over the summer to the Obama people, and then in late summer to the McCain people. And the McCain people subsequently have asked if I wanted them back, and so what I've done with them is brought them into the White House, into the basement of the press room, so that reporters can use them.
All right. Well, we'll let you go to your many duties today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks. Bye. Well, that's nice to know, Professor Feifner. Maybe the president-elect is reading one of your books now, huh?
Well, the president-elect is awful busy. His people may look at it, but I doubt if he's reading it.
Some people have said, I wonder if you agree with this, that what a president does during this transition period, and we just did this phenomenally interesting book on the Lincoln transition period, which, what a time in history that was, says oodles about how this president will govern, then whether or not we're going to like him, whether or not we trust him to lead us, will be established by January 20th.
Well, I think that's largely true. It really sets the tone how the new president-elect, and as soon as a president is elected, all of a sudden the approval rating of this person jumps up. And basically everybody, most people in the United States of both parties, want a new president to succeed. Also, of course, this is before the new president will have made very many policy choices, so everybody can think that he or she is going to promote the policies that they like. But the first sort of official things that the president does is to designate members of the cabinet and the White House staff, and then this certainly sends a message. And President-elect Obama has put together a team of people to work on his economic policy. Often presidents introduce their cabinet members one at a time, but it's interesting that President-elect Obama introduced his economic people as a team, and also his national security policy people as a team.
Mm.
And this says, I think, something about him and the deliberate nature that he's way that he's going about putting together his administration.
Mm-hmm. And what about some cabinet positions being more important than others? Are they? There was some criticism that Richardson got a, conciliatory prize here, not a big one.
Well, the key cabinet positions, state and defense, certainly when we're in two wars, are just really important. And Treasury and Justice are the other two that are kind of key. Those are the first cabinet departments created in the United States, and they're known as the inner cabinet. Since that time, many other, about 10 or so other cabinet departments have been created and are in the presidency. But it really depends on what the priorities, the policy priorities of the new president are. As to which cabinet members are most important. But those four are always key in every presidency.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think of the nominations? Are there some that you would like to single out and say, oh, what a brilliant appointment, and others you would say, we'll see how it works?
Well, I've gotten none of in the second category, but in the first category, I think he's picked some really good people. I think Senator Clinton will make a very good Secretary of State. She's got experience traveling around the world. She has White House experience. She's been in the Senate. She knows the world very well. She knows U.S. policies well. I think she's going to make a first-rate Secretary of State, and I think it speaks to President-elect Obama's confidence in himself that he can appoint somebody who is a former rival to work with him in bringing the government together and presenting the government of the United States to the rest of the world. And I think Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, is a very experienced. She's been involved in a lot of this down in her state, Arizona. She's very good. And I think the choice of Robert Gates to continue as Secretary of Defense as for a while is a wise one. We've got two wars going. We've got major changes in both of those wars. We've got other hotspots around the world. So I think that kind of continuity is very useful, and it shows that President-elect Obama is reaching out to the Republican Party also in trying to present a solid foreign policy mm-hmm. for the United States.
What about Susan Rice?
UN ambassador. She seems, she's been with President-elect Obama. She knows the way he thinks about these things, and that's a key position for her representing the United States to the United Nations.
And also a basketball player. I was interested in that news. He's got a team who can play if they can find some place in the White House to play basketball.
Yes, well, it's interesting. There used to be a swimming pool there during John Kennedy's time. There's a bowling alley there, excuse me, during Richard Nixon's time. Maybe there'll be a basketball hoop set up there. Who knows?
I was interested in some, I think it was an NPR story about the transition, and they said this. I'm wondering about your response. As for the Republicans in the House of Representatives, they may as well go get some old DVDs of the West Wing, because that's as close to the White House as they will get.
Well, I'm not sure about that entirely, because most presidents bring members of Congress from the other party in, especially the leadership, when they're working on important policy issues to try to compromise and so forth. So I expect that President Obama, once he takes office, will be bringing in Republicans from both the House and the Senate for various purposes. But, of course, the Democrats are going to have a first shot at that, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about the vetting process. I understand that for people who want positions in the White House, you have to answer this very, very long series of questions. What have we learned about not proper vetting from other administrations, and will the vetting process be more thorough this go around?
Well, it's getting sort of ratcheted up each election, and it is very thorough. Part of the problem is just minor scandals. At President Clinton's time, Zoe Baird had a nanny problem, meaning that one of the people that was taking care of her children was not in the country legally, and that turned out to be a scandal. With immigration issues so important, these people are going to be vetted. You know, was your gardener a legal alien? Are you paying Social Security tax and so mm-hmm. forth? These are relatively minor issues, although vetting is important for potential major problems that may come up, conflict of interest and so forth. But it's really a long and arduous process. The FBI has to run a full field investigation on these people for clearances to make sure that they, there's no dubious connections in their background, that there's no conflicts of interest. And so the White House runs its own questions. And the key is, have you done anything in your past that might embarrass the president? And that's where you have to reach back and say, oh, gosh, do I have to tell him about this? But the problem is that the opposition out there is going to find it if it's out there. And so the president's people need to know that it's there to be ready to deal with it if it comes up. But, of course, then the Senate also has a whole bunch of another set of questions that you have to answer in the Office of Government Ethics in terms of financial disclosure and so forth. So it's very complicated, and it takes a long time, and it is arduous, and probably some of it is overdone.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to an email. Has there ever been the case where there was a death or maybe serious illness of a talented or experienced person available for or interested in key cabinet or high government jobs during the transition, such that certain posts were difficult to fill, or have there always been a superabundance of applicants? David in Menominee.
Well, there's always a superabundance of applicants. Everybody wants to work for the new president, it seems. And amazingly enough, that over 300,000 people have applied online for the Obama to work with the Obamas. It's just, and this happens in every administration, but this is a particularly large number. So there's always plenty of applicants. The problem is finding the people who are really best and able to do the job, and often they're not the ones applying. So that's really difficult. I can't think of any particular deaths of cabinet designees that have caused problems, but usually the president has a list of probably, you know, 4, 5, or 10 people for each cabinet position, you know, that his team has put together for his or her consideration. And if one, for one reason or another, drops out, there's usually several other people who are qualified and whom the president feels comfortable enough to designate for those positions.
I would imagine, just because of the nature of this presidency, that there would be the eyes of the world and of the country are going to be looking at this presidency forevermore.
Well, that's right. In any new presidency, that the whole world looks on to see what are, you know, what can we tell about how this president is going to act by the kinds of people that he or she puts in certain positions, and certainly the foreign policy positions. All the other nations in the world are looking very careful at these, you know, trying to read the tea leaves, which direction is he going, and so forth. So designating these people, you know, sort of the first official, quasi-official acts of the president-elect is very important.
We welcome phone calls, and here's our number if you'd like to join us. I can't believe you're so silent today, everybody. I wonder if the phones are working. So give us a call. What do you think of this transition process? What are your thoughts about how the president-elect has handled this so far? What makes it smooth? Where are the bumpy spots here? Will his presidency essentially be set even before the inaugural address, and we'll have to talk about the inaugural address as well, because we're looking very carefully at who he's announcing to give you a strong idea of where he's going. What have you learned from other transitions that maybe have not gone very smoothly? Well, join us, okay? Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, which some of you have done already, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our guest this hour is Professor James Feifner. He's a professor in the School of Public Policy at George Mason University. He is from, as are his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and he went to UW-Madison for his BA, MA, and for his PhD. So we certainly welcome your phone calls. Somebody just call and see if – there we go. All right. See if the phones here are working, because – I would think that you would have a lot to say about this. Professor Feifner has written or edited a dozen books on the presidency and American national government, including The Strategic Presidency, Hitting the Ground Running, and Power Play, The Bush Presidency and the Constitution. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor James Feifner is our guest now, and we're taking phone calls at 800-486-8655, starting our calls with Jake will be joining us from Menasha. So Jake will be with you just a moment. We'll be with you right now. Hi, Jake.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Okay. I have a quick question for the guest.
Sure.
He briefly commented that the vetting process was overdone and too bureaucratic. Could he elaborate on that? Is this more of the big government out of control scenario?
I think it's less the big government out of control than an overabundance of caution. People look back and they remember, oh, there was a slight scandal about this or that, and then in order to solve that problem, they put a whole bunch of new restrictions on people. Whenever I guess it's similar to the sense of, you know, when something goes wrong, you do all sorts of things to stop that from happening. But in doing all of those things, those new restrictions, they keep out other good people also. So I think, you know, the conflict of interest things, how much stock you can hold in companies and so forth. Clearly, you've got to have rules about if you own stock in a company that you can't make decisions about that company. But other sorts of rules about who you can talk to and so forth tend to get piled up and piled up, and they're never taken away. So that is part of the dynamic, I think.
Thanks very much, Jake, for your call. We go now to Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I had a question for the professor about the Eric Holder nomination for Attorney General. You know, it seems that he's got one incident in his past that is taking on an excessive proportion relative to his accomplishments. And I was wondering if you think there's really going to be a problem with him being approved as Attorney General.
The Mark Rich pardon, or are you thinking of something else?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Okay.
I think I agree with Jim that is a relatively minor incident. I mean, the President of the United States gets to choose whom to pardon and whom not to pardon. President Clinton had that authority, and he made the decision. It wasn't Eric Holder that made it. Holder was just doing his job in terms of pardons, which are done and prepared in the Justice Department. So I think that it's the President's decision, and I agree with Jim that this should not be something that will be a big deal.
What about his comments on detainees in Guantanamo?
Well, I think the President-elect has said that he would like to close Guantanamo, which will be very complicated, but he's also said that he disapproves of the kind of harsh questioning, often amounting to torture, that had taken place there. The military now has changed their policies back, and so back to conform with the Geneva Conventions, so that should no longer be a problem. But with respect to the CIA, there's still some doubt because there are secret memos that written by President Bush about what the CIA can do. But I think the President has the authority to make those decisions, and President-elect Obama, or when he becomes President, can make an create an executive order telling the CIA to conform to the Geneva Conventions. But I think Guantanamo now is conforming to the Geneva Conventions because of changes in military policy and the Detainee Treatment Act that was passed in 2005.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Eric Holder's comments, at which point I've heard it reported that he believed it was okay to hold these people there because of the war on terrorism.
Well, it depends on which people. Originally, the Bush administration claimed that everybody there was a terrorist, and we knew it for sure. And then we found out that clearly many of those people were not. They were swept up. Some of them were turned in by bounties. The United States picked up about 5% of the people in Guantanamo were actually captured by United States troops. The others were captured by other allies in Afghanistan and handed over to the United States, and it turned out that many of those people were not guilty. More than 500, total of about 770 have been in Guantanamo. About 500, more than 500 have been released, and many of those clearly not threats to the United States. On the other hand, some of those people clearly are threats to the United States, and those people should be kept and prosecuted, but the problem, of course, is potentially if some of the evidence came through torture, that would be problematic. So it's going to be very difficult, but I think clearly there are some of those people that are bad guys and some of them who are there by mistake.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Jim?
That's all. Thanks very much for your comments.
Thanks for your call. Mark is next from Romance. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As a progressive and being pretty active in this last campaign, I've been disappointed that thus far we haven't really seen strong progressive voices in these appointments, particularly when it comes to the economy. But I also have to say, at the same time I struggle with that, I have this sense that Obama knows what the heck he's doing, and I trust him, and I hope my trust is not misplaced. But for the moment, I'm willing to just give him the benefit of the doubt and to see how things unfold. And I was just kind of interested in the thoughts of your
That's interesting.
That.
He does seem to know what the heck he's doing, doesn't he?
He certainly does. And as I said before, he's prepared this very well. He's acting very deliberately. And I think in his appointments, he's being very careful. He's being moderate in the appointments. But the key, I think, is that the decisions in the executive branch are going to be made by President Obama once he's inaugurated. And those are the key policies. And whoever he's appointed, I think, is going to go along with them. And so regardless of the what you perceive the cabinet members, advisors, and so forth, what their positions are, they're really going to be the policies of President Obama. So it is hard to tell where he's going. He seems to be moderate. But I take some comfort in that he's picking members of the cabinet, the White House staff, who really look competent, who have experience. And if you want to change policy, I think you've got to have people that know how to do it, who have been there before, and who are very effective at it. And I think that he's choosing those kinds of people.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call, Mark. We go to Buzz from Hudson. Hi, Buzz.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks so much.
It's Kathleen, actually. It's Kathleen.
Thank you for your guest.
Okay.
I just wanted to comment on the character and integrity of President-elect Obama, and I'm thinking about some words from his acceptance speech in Grand Park when he said, "There are perhaps those of you who did not vote for me." But I will still be your president, and I need your help. Mm. And I think those words just speak to the depth and genuineness of this wonderful leader who will lead by example and pull this nation and our world together. Mm. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think Buzz is right. Other presidents, like President Nixon, have said that they were going to unite the country. President Bush said he was a uniter, not a divider. And some of those promises did not come through. President-elect Obama has said that he wants to be the leader of the whole nation. And I think both Republicans and Democrats want to see him succeed. And so I think that, you know, the speech was very effective in doing that. It was a sober speech, well done. And I think that signals his intention.
This man knows how to give a speech. I know a lot of people are looking forward to the inaugural. Even those who disagreed with what he had to say during the campaign gave him the fact that he can talk.
Well, that's right. Not only talk, he can compose a speech.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And do it effectively. Mm-hmm. And the inaugural, first inaugural of every president is really a key. Often they're historic. Certainly you think back to John Kennedy's inaugural, and it was so inspiring and brought lots of people into the government that idealistic people who thought, you know, the government, we can actually do some good with this. And I think Obama is a similar kind of character. And, you know, his inaugural speech, expectations are very high, but I think he's going to meet them.
We go next to Susie from Denmark. Hi, Susie. Susie, are you there? Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join the conversation. Have you wanted to be a part of an administration, Professor Feifner? If they're reading your books, why don't you get in there and give them a few thoughts.
Well, it's really different sort of analyzing and looking at and trying to understand an administration and actually being in there and administering. I'm the kind of person, and I'm a professor, a scholar, so I like to sit back and watch and analyze things and figure it out. But when you're there, you've got to make immediate decisions. You've got to make decisions without enough information. You're working, 12, 14-hour days. It's very hectic. But you also have to enjoy the give and take of politics and being in there acting all the time. So that's certainly attractive, but what I prefer is to try to analyze it and come up with really firm answers before I make any decisions. So I think I'm in the right position advising rather than doing.
Mm-hmm. Pat from Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I wanted to know if Mr. Obama was going to put someone in place that would coordinate communications between the various security agencies. It seems like that's been missing in the past.
That's a good question.
Yes, and I think since 9/11, we've been very sensitive to communications, particularly between the FBI and the CIA. And there's always been rivalries among these different agencies. And there have been some administrative barriers to what sorts of things you can convey. You know, that the problem is some of this stuff is very sensitive, some of the secrets and intelligence. But they have to communicate, as we learned in 9/11. So I think that the processes have been put in place already for good communication. But also I think President-elect Obama, when he designates the top people in these agencies, a lot of that makes a lot of difference. And if they are willing and understand the importance of cross-communication, I think that'll take place. But I do think already in place are the procedures that are facilitating that, and it's much better now than it was 4 or 5 years ago, I think.
So So his national security advisor, General Jones, I believe it is.
Yes.
This is going to be something that's going to be a priority for him?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a priority across the intelligence communities and national security agencies. It's just crucial. People are aware of it now, and I think it's going to happen that way.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Pat. We go to Glenn next from Manitowoc. Hi, Glenn.
Oh, good morning. I was curious as whether the professor would agree with my assessment as to Obama appears to be incredibly well-read historically speaking. I'm looking at his picks and his challenges of the divisiveness of this country. I even see tongue-in-cheek the old adage of keep your friends close and your enemies even closer with his pick of Hillary in regards to 4 years from now. This man seems to be really looking at things long-term and correctly appraising his challenges. What was Professor say about that?
Well, I think it's right. I think Obama does have the long view, and you could see that when he decided to throw his hat in the ring, because at that point it didn't look like he had much of a chance. It looked like Senator Clinton had soaked up a lot of the Democratic money, a lot of the Democratic talent, and she had. She and her husband are formidable campaigners in Democratic politics, but Obama had the foresight to see that he did have a chance, ran a very effective campaign, and actually won. So I think you're right. I think he is well-read. He's very well-educated, editor of the Harvard Law Review, and keeping his adversaries, not enemies, close is part, I think, of his talent to bring together the country, you know, both in terms of the factions in the Democratic Party, but also reaching across the aisle to Republicans, because he knows that it's crucial that the president be supported by the full country and not just one faction of it.
Professor Feifner, thanks so much for being with us. Please join us again.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Professor James Feifner, our guest this part of the show, University Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University. And we thank Professor Kumar from the Presidential Transition Project, White House Transition Project, for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and John Treader. This is the Ideas Network.